Siberia has a reputation as a vast, cold, often bleak terrain with an often tragic history just beneath the surface. But Sophie Roberts' mission to search for the grand pianos that were shipped to remote corners of Siberia centuries ago gave her a chance to see a more intimate side of the Russian interior and its Far East. She describes her journey about searching for a fitting piano to take care of a promising musician in Mongolia in her book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia. Sophie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Siberia is this vast land, 20% of the land on the whole planet, and it's sort of an area where you don't cross a border and it says you're in Siberia. It's just this vast eastern hinterland of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. It's got a nickname as the prison without a roof, a place of exile and banishment. Talk just a minute before we get into pianos about Siberia as this eastern extension of both Tsarist Russia and the Soviet Union.
Yes, indeed. It's a very loose description. Chekhov said it best when he was there in the 1890s, and he talked about it beginning somewhere in Ekaterinburg, which is a city in the Ural Mountains, and ending, this is a wonderful phrase, goodness knows where. I took that to be Kamchatka, right out into the Pacific. It's huge. It's vast. It was this great prison without a roof. 1801 to 1917, we're talking about 1 million subjects banished to Siberia under the Tsarist penal exile system, and then the Gulag system from 1929 to 53, we're talking about 2.7 million forced laborers dying in the Soviet Gulag. Unreliable numbers, unthinkable numbers. You can't put a face or a word to describe how unfathomable that really is. But when I started to look for pianos, and I started to search for the human stories in those numbers, I discovered something else.
What is music, and what do piano tuners and what do great pianos have to do with this vast gulag zone of the Tsarist Russia and the Soviet Union?
Well, it was very interesting because what happened was under Catherine the Great, it began with her and it picked up pace into the 19th century, is an incredible piano mania in European Russia. So in St. Petersburg and Moscow, they couldn't make pianos quick enough. When Franz Liszt comes to play in 1842 in St. Petersburg, it's described like it's a modern day rock concert. You know, people are grabbing at Liszt's hair, they're picking up the cherry pips that he's spitting from his mouth to wear them as amulets. So there's this fever for pianos. In one of the 19th century critics talks about how in a block of 100 apartments, 93 would have pianos. The piano tuners couldn't satisfy demand fast enough. And what also happened was these instruments started to move across those Urals into Siberia with governors, with exiles, with mavericks, with misfits, dragging them on sledges. We're talking about a time before the railway.
Sophie, it's interesting that it's hard today. For many people, a piano is just, what am I going to do with this big thing? Because, you know, we've got everything so electronic and at our fingertips and streaming. But back in the middle of the 1800s, there was no recorded music. People had a hunger for culture, and there wasn't a symphony or an orchestra within a five-day horse ride. Explain the importance of the piano back then that we might have a hard time appreciating today.
But I think to understand the context, you're in, first of all, an incredibly severe climate, a very lonely place. You're among people that haven't all chosen to be there, the exiles that were coming in. You wanted to hold on to something from your past. You wanted to hold on to something that represented your history, your culture, your context. And the piano, that instrument, that piece of furniture, if you will, provided both a symbolic and a very real connection with what they'd left behind. So it became the repository of enormous connection, of emotion, of story, of loves lost, passions remembered. It became a center to their lives. And the piano in Siberia had, to me anyway, in the stories that I discovered, it had a different resonance somehow because of the sheer remoteness of its locale.
Were people more forgiving, or were these pianos just like horrible pianos, so horribly out of tune? Or do you think in the day, a wealthy person, even in the depths of Siberia, would have the wherewithal to have a proper piano technician make the piano sound good so you could have, in the middle of this vast cultural wasteland, a great pianist playing great music? They're just like a beautiful shining light in the middle of the snowy tundra.
You described that beautifully, and indeed that was and remains the case. The piano tuners were the keys to the kingdom for me, both in history and in the present day. Back in the 19th century, the stories of them traveling all the way from Kiev to the borders of Mongolia to tune the pianos of wealthy merchants. Bit by bit, a homegrown industry started to evolve. There were piano-making factories in Siberia itself. The other thing I think is important to mention is this is in the Tsarist period, when there was people of wealth who could afford, with their great fortunes through silver mines and the rest, to have pianos. In the Soviet period, and this is what I found very interesting, the piano was much more accessible. It was an everyday instrument. It wasn't a kind of instrument of the bourgeoisie, of the concert hall and privilege, as it is in the West, perhaps. It was available to many. So the levels of musical education, which you still feel in the Siberians that I was talking to, is very, very high. And the concert pianist Denis Matsuev said it to me right at the beginning. He says, don't underestimate Siberia. They're my most demanding audience. They know exactly what they're listening to. And that high level of musical education, I was, you know, you talk about it often, Rick, that sort of ethnocentricity is completely skewed. And you realize that you're approaching these things wrongly, perhaps.
You know, Sophie, one of my favorite memories of Warsaw, which is a Slavic country also, was going to an elegant salon, a little social room in a fancy house, and hearing one pianist playing to a small gathering of people that love classical music. And it was such a beautiful, intimate moment as they were playing Chopin right there in the homeland of Chopin. And I can just imagine the salons and the beautiful little concerts with people that craved classical music all across Siberia, especially in the 19th century. This is Travel with Rick Steves. If you ever needed a reason to explore the far reaches of Siberia, Sophie Roberts went there on a mission to find the historic pianos that were given new homes in the most remote corners of Russia. She describes what she encountered over 2 years of travels in her book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia. Photos and videos from her journeys are featured on the website lostpianosofsiberia.com. Sophie, when you think of 2 years of exploring Siberia for these pianos, what are a couple of pianos that really told a story to you? What were a couple of the examples of the amazing pianos with their own history that you found?
Well, there was one in the city of Akademgorodok, which is the science city outside of Novosibirsk. And with help from locals, I tracked down the last piano belonging to a lady called Vera Lota Shevchenko, who was a French pianist. Le Figaro described her as an absolute shining light of her time. She married a Russian, and she, for one reason or another, ended up in the gulag. She spent 8 years in that gulag, and she used to practice on a wooden keyboard carved into the side of her bunk. On the day she was released, she walked out in her prisoner's pea coat, and she knocked on the door of a music school and asked if she could play a piano. And it was an incredible moment. People stood at the door listening to this magnificent squall of Chopin, Bach, and the rest. And she'd held that music in her head for 8 years. Mm. And these academics in the city of Akademgorodok, they found out about her story. They brought her in. She'd lost her husband in the gulag. He disappeared. And they brought her in, and they helped her with a piano. And she had a grand piano in her apartment until the day she died. And I tracked that down with the help of some wonderful Russians. This story, this was the whole thing about the hunt. It unraveled into something else. I then met her last tuner. Her last tuner survived the siege of Leningrad. He survived it, he said, by his own description, through music. He would listen to music on an old record player, effectively, that his mother gave him. And music gave him solace. Music gave him hope. Music made him think it would be all okay. And that, if you like, hits at the core of why I found the whole hunt relevant to me. It told me what music can do.
I grew up appreciating this. My dad was a beloved piano tuner, and we wouldn't even be talking now had he not decided to import great pianos from Germany. And I know how people appreciated bringing him into their house to give them what he called the Steve Sound of Music, you know. And people would trade in a miserable old little upright piano for a grand piano built with fine craftsmanship from Germany. And to think of the relief and the joy that brought people just here in Seattle, when you think about that in the middle of Siberia, when you think about that a century ago, it's just inspiring. And your book shines a light on that. And something your book also does is use this story of this love of music and this hunger for culture to talk about the humanity of a place like Siberia. You write about how you could knock on a door and say, "Do you have a piano here?" And all of a sudden, you'd have a circle of friends. Talk a little bit about how your book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia, is sort of a tool or an avenue to just explore the humanity of Siberia and, on a broader sort of scale, how we're connected with people all over the world.
Yes, it's an important question because I am a traveler. I'm an addicted traveler. And I didn't realize that Siberia was going to become so significant for me. But what happened as a Western traveler in Russia, I was approaching it full of stereotypes, full of assumptions, full of politics. But knocking on the doors in these remote places as a Western woman saying, "Have you got a piano?" Everything fell away. It was peculiar. It was a bit odd. And the doors opened. And from that single question, I would spend 2, 3, 4, 5 days with people that welcomed me in. So that allowed me to get into the place, into the culture, into the food, into the drink, into the stories and playing with their children. You know, it allowed me access into that kind of granular level of a place that sometimes is hard to reach as a traveler. So yes, in many ways, looking for a piano was an excuse to understand a place. But I hope there's also another narrative that tells the history of this territory and its relationship with music. So there's a few things going on, I admit that. But for me, it was definitely a passport somehow to being trusted and trusting others.
We're talking to Sophie Roberts, the author of The Lost Pianos of Siberia, from her home studio right now on Travel with Rick Steves. In the book, Sophie details her adventure searching for historic pianos that were shipped to Siberia from European Russia. Sophie also hosts a podcast on the art of travel called Gone to Timbuktu. A new series of her interviews is due to be released shortly. You can find a short video from Sophie's adventure in Siberia at sophieroberts.com. Sophie is spelled S-O-P-H-Y. You wrote that it's been suggested that when you hear the hush of silver birch trees and winter snow in the big soft chords of Russian music, that's sort of what we're talking about, what we're searching for here. Is there a piece that brings back the best impressions of Siberia that you like to go to when you hear it?
Yes, there is a Mongolian piece written by a contemporary composer called Shirav, called Awaken Step. It was the piece I first heard my friend, for whom I was looking for a piano, a young Mongolian pianist. It was a piece I first heard her play on a Yamaha that wasn't quite up to scratch. It was one of the pieces that night in a recital in a tent on a hillside in the middle of the Mongolian steppe that stayed with me, that and Bach, the Appassionata. There's so many, but when you hear the thundering horses on the steppe, that steppe transcends modern borders. It belongs to Mongolia, it belongs to Siberia. When you hear a piano, just a piano, no singing voice, no orchestra, nothing else, there's a sort of clarity that belongs to that icy landscape somehow. It's a hard one to describe, but every time it moved me, those two pieces of music.
And Sophie, there's the very human story of the Mongolian musician that needs a great piano that you got to know and cared for. Can you just explain how that sort of is the plot of your book? Talk about the Mongolian musician and what happened.
Of course. I've been going to Mongolia for many years. It's somewhere where my family and I spend time. We made friends with a family that live about 8 hours outside the capital, Ulaanbaatar, and they live in a remote valley. And this young Mongolian pianist was there in the summer of 2015. She was teaching piano to some of the local kids, and she was playing on a Yamaha that had seen better days. You know, it's a very brutal climate, Mongolia. You know, they talk about how in winter it gets so cold that the cows' tails snap in too. So you can imagine what that does to a piano. Anyway, she was playing music. I was listening in a very small and intimate space in one of these Mongolian tents with felted sides, perfect acoustics. She was playing some Bach. The music was going up with the smoke through the hole in the center up to a kind of starlit sky. I thought it was very moving, but my friend, who knows much more about music and sound than I, said, "Oh goodness, no, it's not quite right. We must find her one of the lost pianos of Siberia." He's a German. He knows his history. And what he was talking about was this extraordinary moment in Russia's history when they brought in the great makers from the German-speaking states and the piano mania took off in Russia. So there was a kind of a historical line that I could start to take while also looking for an instrument that was worthy of my friend's talent. So that was where the quest began, interestingly, in Mongolia. But of course, look at a map. It's very, very close to the border with Siberia.
That's right. Again, my dad was a piano tuner and he loved pianos and he appreciated the history of pianos. And I remember he had a book with all the serial numbers and all the piano makers. You could look at the serial number of a piano and you go, oh, that was a Steinway from the 1920s. Those were the good years. Did you encounter that sort of, you know, here's an almanac of serial numbers and we can read into the story from the serial number of the piano that was made by this or that company?
Yes, yes, so often. It was amazing that it was like a detective hunt. I mean, of course, Russia's 20th century history is very disturbed. There's a lot of lost provenance and all the rest of it. But those serial numbers were really very important. And, you know, Steinway, for instance, keep very, very close record of it. Others lost records during the war. But I will never forget meeting a piano tuner in Kamchatka who was in his late 70s. And every piano he had ever tuned, he produced his notepad. It was written with the serial number. It was incredible, just this history of commitment. And, you know, the piano tuners are, I've seen them walk onto a stage at Carnegie Hall, and they never have a name. You never recognize their importance, but they're the kind of unsung hero to my mind. And they certainly are of my book. They are real heroes. They are working away, protecting these instruments, holding on to their stories and making sure they don't all end up on a bonfire. And yes, it was important, those serial numbers. They were part of the treasure hunt, I guess.
Sophie, I didn't realize this conversation with you would lead to such emotions for me, but my father, all of his life, he was the piano tuner behind the scenes, and he would love these pianos. He would sign his business card, tuned by Richard Steves on this date to A440, and he would put it there, and then the musicians would run it over the goal line, and they would just love it. To think about that amplified almost infinitely in that vast Siberian prison without a roof, and to think of the importance of culture and the resilience of the human spirit and what we can learn from traveling, I'm so inspired. And I just think it must have been so exciting and gratifying for you to find this story and then to be able to write about it in your book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing what you've learned.
Thank you, Rick.
Let's close today's Travel with Rick Steves by hearing Sophie's Mongolian pianist friend, Adgirl, play a nocturne written by John Field on the actual piano that Sophie found for her in Siberia.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. You can listen to a podcast version of the show whenever you like at ricksteves.com/radio and from most podcast providers. We'll look for you again next week with another Travel with Rick Steves.